Welcome back to Elevation Trail with me, Tim Long, and Gary David. How are you doing today, Gary?
I have a confession to make.
Oh, man, every week you make a confession about something.
That's because I have a lot to confess. And this week, I have to confess that I've turned into one of those people that I despise.
What's that?
In that, I already put up my Christmas tree, my Christmas lights on my house.
Sweet.
The Christmas lights are on the house. Not the Christmas tree. We haven't gotten that far yet. But the Christmas lights are on the house. The candy canes are in front of the house. And our house is lit.
I like it.
Every night with the festival atmosphere that is Christmas.
Well, with three daughters, I think it's important that you guys have that stuff taken care of right away.
It wasn't so much that, although that contributed to it. It was the fact that last weekend it was 60 degrees out. And you know that you got to grab that opportunity when you have it because, for instance, this weekend, it's going to be about 35 degrees out. And putting Christmas tree lights up when it's 35 degrees out on an aluminum ladder, yeah, not so much fun. So I figured, well, might as well take the leap, put the Christmas tree lights up, or Christmas house lights up, I should say, and be done with it. That way I cannot worry about it anymore. So that's done, and yeah. We got them up. We're the first ones on the street. So, you know, we were the winners.
Congratulations.
Thanks. And we had them up at the same time that our neighbors still have their Halloween lights up.
Oh.
Although I think we shamed them into taking their Halloween lights down because shortly after we put the Christmas tree lights up or the Christmas house lights up, Christmas lights up, The Halloween lights came down. So I think we have become those people. And I do have to say I am not a huge fan of Christmas. One could say I don't like it at all, and it's not so much the holiday; it's the commodification of the holiday.
Yeah. Well, you want to know how much I like Christmas? You want to know what my tradition is?
Tell me.
Watching Christmas Vacation with Chevy Chase. That's it.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. I don't like watching Home Alone.
No, Home Alone sucks.
Not a fan. I don't necessarily like watching It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
Because I think that, you know, they just should have, you know, gotten a group together and just completely beat the snot out of Mr. Potter and made him disappear, have an accident. I think that would have solved that whole problem. And I think actually, you know, Henry Fonda has a better work than that. And I do like, you know, A Christmas Story, but that's so overplayed. It's just like everything else around Christmas. It's too much. Mm-hmm. And so I'm driving in my car, and the one station that dedicates itself to Christmas music 24 hours a day has already done so. It's just too much too soon.
Yeah,
and it's
I used to work when I lived in Boston. I worked on Milk Street, which right around the corner from Macy's. So you can imagine. And right around the corner from Finagle a Bagel, which I missed tremendously. But anyway, you can imagine how much Christmas stuff I got around the holidays when I lived there. But I do – that's one of the many things I miss about New England is being there for Christmas actually was kind of nice.
It gets cool, but, you know, it's just, you know, like anything else. How can we take something that's enjoyable and raise it to the nth level to the extent that we destroy any semblance of what it's supposed to be about?
I know. It's almost like Lifetime Fitness took over ownership of Christmas.
Wow. Look out. Yeah. So I put my Christmas house lights up, and that's exciting. And I'm also doing a single speed race this weekend.
Oh, jealous, man.
I've never done a single speed cross race before, and this will be my first one.
That sounds exciting. I almost purchased a single-speed mountain bike.
Oh, I don't have a single-speed bike.
What are you doing?
This is a trick, especially when you have running SRAM, is that you just zip-tie your shifting lever to your brake lever.
Mm.
And it prevents shifting.
Okay. And they allow that? That's okay?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's single-speed, man. I mean, you know, this will be an interesting thing to track as well. When does single-speed racing start taking itself too seriously? Because it's not gotten to that point yet. And so, yeah, you can absolutely zip-tie your shifter to your brake lever and run it that way.
Well, Gary,
so that's what I'm going to do.
What are you going to run, like a 52-16?
Yeah, I'm going to run a 53, 14.
12?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Go big or go home. I don't know. It's on Sunday morning when it's supposed to be, I think the low on Sunday is supposed to be around 28 degrees.
Nice.
So tire selection is going to be very important. Given that I'm only running one set of tires right now, it makes the selection a lot easier.
Spikes. I would put spikes in.
No, yeah, actually, when it's really, really, you know, hard like that, file treads are not a bad way to go. I understand they're the brand new Challenge chicanes, which were developed by a good friend of mine, Helen Wyman, the current cyclocross champion of Europe. Her and her husband Steph developed a chicane, which is kind of a combination of a file tread with a knobby side from the Challenge Limus, and so it kind of gives you both. So yeah, I mean, I don't know. I got that going on this weekend, doing a cross race again finally after the marathon.
Sounds like so much fun. I'd ridden the last 2 days. It was actually the first time I've ridden, I think, since Leadville in August. And
really?
I got out on the mountain bike last 2 days. It was tons of fun. Yeah, Tyler got a new mountain bike, too, so dragged her out the day before yesterday, and she did pretty well. I was surprised.
Why were you surprised? Because
I was a little nervous. Well? I took her out to this course that I felt was a little above her ability, but every time I looked back, she's just like rolling over stuff that I was like cringing going over myself. And just big smile. So yeah, it worked
out
well.
That's cool.
I think it helps when you're not aware of what your danger is in front of you. And
yeah,
you just kind of go at it. I was just like, just trust your bike and roll over stuff. And she's like going off like 5 foot drop offs. So it was good. We had a good time. Then I went out yesterday by myself and rode around for an hour and a half, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I was worried about you.
Oh, really? I'm touched. What were you worried about me about?
Just too much human interaction too soon.
Yeah, dude, I know.
The fact that you have gone from compound, A, or compound 1.0, now you're in compound 2.0.
Yeah,
which is almost the same as compound 1.0, but now with more human beings. And so I was a little bit concerned about how you were going to manage that transition.
It did take a little to getting used to. I mean, I went from almost zero human interaction except for going to the grocery store and seeing the people there.
And I've been to that grocery store that you used to go to, and
they
call that human interaction as being generous.
I know. I didn't want to be mean. I went from that to daily human interaction. And not only that, but like with all the, the five jobs that I have now, I'm like,
right.
I'm on Skype half the day with people from around the world. And, And then I have to like talk to people when I go outside. And
I hate that.
I know it gets old, but I'm getting used to it and getting a little bit better. I've learned to zip up my pants, instead of just walking around with my fly open and no shoes on.
Are you drinking less?
Less what?
Less than before.
Less beer?
Yeah.
No, God.
Oh, okay.
If anything, it's increased.
Okay. Just checking.
Yeah. It helps. It helps get me through the day with
numb
people.
The pain.
Yeah.
Right. And the kind of beer you drink, you do have to drink a lot of it to have any impact.
I know.
Any impact because it's such a
It is. That's why I drink the watery
choice.
Beer because I like the taste of it and I don't want to be wasted. Mm-hmm. So,
right.
Whatever.
So, right. Yeah, that's what's going on with me.
Anything else with you? Because, you talked a lot about yourself.
Yeah, enough about me. Let's talk about me for a second. No, I'm just actually after the marathon, just finding my training mojo again. I actually did a pretty good interval workout on the bike this morning on the trainer and had a good trail hour run yesterday. And I got this 40-mile trail race coming up in about three weeks. So that's happening on December 7th, 40-miler.
Cool.
Yeah. And it's supposed to be kind of hard. The tricky thing there right now in the trails in New England is that there's a lot of leaves on the trail, a lot of leaves. And so trying to figure out where to put your feet when you're running, it's like every step is a leap of faith because you don't know if there's a rock root, whatever. So that's going to make it kind of challenging. That's coming up. So just trying to round out the bike season, round out the trail ultra season and kind of get into Christmas and just chill a little bit.
Yeah. God, you're doing a lot of racing. I'm super jealous. I miss it.
I'm about done.
Yeah.
I am about done.
Well,
I've had enough fun.
I got to race last weekend.
Yeah, you got to race.
Yeah, it was exciting, actually.
You did well.
Yeah. Sort of. I'm super happy with the time and more than happy. I'm just surprised, actually, because I honestly, not sandbagging at all, was just hoping to run under 4 hours.
Yeah.
just based on the climb and stuff, I mean, it all took place. It was a Rimrock Marathon, which the Mesa Striders put on. They do a super job with a tiny race, you know, for a marathon anyway, a road marathon. And goes up and over the Colorado National Monument, and so it's all between like 5,000 and 7,000 feet elevation, and with like 20, I ended up with like 2,300 feet of climb.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was just like hoping to get through it and do under 4 hours, and, you know, just started rolling with it in the beginning and ended up running the first half in 1:36, and that's all the climbing, and then it descends back down into Fruta, Colorado. And I ran a 1:29 in the second half, so ended up with a 3:05.
That is screaming.
Yeah.
Downhill courses ain't easy.
I know. Well, I'll tell you what. You know what motivated me was because you ran a 3:05 a couple weeks previous to that.
Right.
And so I was, like, excited when I started looking at the splits and figuring out that, because that's basically all I do in races is just do the math constantly.
Got to do the math in a road marathon or even a trail marathon. You got to do the math.
Yeah, it keeps your mind off the other stuff. But
right.
I started realizing that I had a slight chance to go under 3:10, and my Boston qualifier standard is 3:20. So I was like ecstatic that I was going to go under that. And then when I started to realize I could get close to 3:05, I was basically sprinting for the last mile. So thanks for the motivation.
Right on. That's great. That's a really good job. And how would you feel afterwards? Did you feel beat up? Did you feel okay?
You know, I was expecting that, like I told, because Tyler ran a 3:55. She took second in her age group. I won my age group, of course, because I'm old fart.
Right.
And took fifth overall, actually. But I was telling her, I'm like, dude, we're not going to be able to walk the rest of the week. You know, we're going to be destroyed without that downhill. And felt great. You know, 2 days later, I was ready to run, but I took 3 days off and then picked it back up.
Good man.
Yeah, good stuff.
Good
So that's pretty much all that's going on in my small life. Today we were supposed to have Tony Reed, who is one of the co-founders of the National Black Marathon Association, that got started in 2003, I believe.
Right.
And, you know, due to some scheduling difficulties, we ended up not having him on the show, obviously, since he's not here. So I was really looking forward to that. And actually, I did a little pre-show research myself because I was pretty excited to have him on. But so that's – well, we'll do that next week, hopefully.
Yeah.
So this week, again, I personally am going to be winging most of what we talk about, as usual. And relying on you and your all the hard work you put in your research.
Yeah, not only the hard work in my research today, but the years of dedication to social analysis and critical inquiry.
Your whole PhD was done just for this podcast, right?
It really has led to this point in my life, because if you think back on all the, you know, my very first sociology class, I can remember my very first sociology class or the course I took in Soc 100 at Central Michigan University, Fire Up Chips. And so we have today this culmination of that lifelong pursuit to be able to dig deep into topics and examine them from multiple angles and really provide what is seriously lacking in today's educational environment and curriculum, which is the ability to think critically about diverse topics and then incorporate those materials together in a way that communicates meaning to those audiences which one finds oneself faced with, you know, on a regular basis. So that's what's happening. It's not just today's research. It's the research I've been done throughout my life.
Yeah. You lost me at Central Michigan University.
Fire Up Chips.
Yeah.
You went to that school down the road.
Yeah. The slightly better one.
MUU.
Yeah. So anyway, today we're going to discuss, speaking of your career.
Right.
And what got us started with you on the show.
Right.
With your original survey and research that you put together for ultra running.
Right.
It's come to almost a finale. You found somebody who is excited.
that's one way to put it.
Yeah. You found somebody who's excited to publish it. I mean,
I did.
I'm amazed that people weren't just like, you know, the second you contacted them weren't, you know, excited to get this thing out for you.
Well, can I talk a little bit about myself for a second?
Yeah, why not? Something new.
Okay, please. And so this is the problem with sociology. I'm going to make this quick. I submitted the manuscript, which you read, the original manuscript you saw. Wasn't horrible, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was okay. Well, I mean, wasn't earth-shattering, but it was a good description of what we found in the study, and some issues that we raised, and some of which we've talked about on this show. I sent it out to a journal that specializes in sports sociology or sociology of sports. Got thoroughly rejected. I mean, I got a letter back really quick. They wouldn't even send it out for a peer review. Because the process is typically you send it to a journal, the editor assigns it to other people to review, and then they give feedback whether it should be rejected outright, you know, screw you, not a chance, this sucks. Revise and resubmit with major revisions, with minor revisions, or just, you know, you're wonderful, we accept it. So the first one I sent it to, they said, no way, we're not going to publish this piece of crap. Why? The major reasons were, even though it was well-written, and even though it was interesting, that it lacked theoretical depth and sociological insight. Now, to which I responded in a very nice letter, thank you very much for the opportunity. Could you please explain to me what is meant by theoretical depth and sociological insight? And I never got a response back.
That's great.
I sent it to another journal. I redid it a little bit, sent it to another sociology of sports journal. They did send it out for reviews. And then got back to me and said, no way in hell we're publishing this.
I mean, you know what struck me, Gary, when you started telling me that these rejections were taking place is, are they really publishing things that are that exciting to read? I mean, I read this thing and it's, yeah, definitely I'm in the sport and whatever, if you want to call it a sport. And I find it interesting. But even from a layperson point of view, I think it's fascinating. Understand why people do these things.
And you just hit on it, something you just said. And this was the problem of the paper. And the reviewer said as much. The layperson's point of view. The second round of reviews said, you know, along with some just nitpicky stuff, you know, I didn't reference certain kinds of articles that were written on ultramarathoning, and I should have. And so I looked at these other articles, as you know, they said I should emulate more, because again, there was no theory; it was just quote unquote descriptive. And I guess the bottom line is I didn't reference Bourdieu enough, Pierre Bourdieu, right? I mean, I didn't have enough theoretical layering on top of it that tried to get at this very high level analysis. Sociological theoretical analysis that really would make it more germane to a smaller audience. So I guess the way that you have a bigger impact is that you reduce your audience. I don't understand it. And it actually goes against some of the things that has been argued in sociology around public sociology. How do we take sociology, bring it into public discourse?
Mm-hmm.
And so, long story short, I was reviewing a book, a completely separate book, not related to ultra running at all. I was reviewing a book by a guy named Ben Agger. And in this book, there's like a few pages on it about running in this book. I'm reading this going, huh, this guy knows something about running. So I look him up. He actually wrote a book on running. Okay. And so I emailed him and said, can you take a look at this manuscript I have and let me know what you think? He's a marathoner. And I was looking for some feedback, and he got back to me and said, I really liked it. I would like to publish it in my online journal and a journal called Fast Capitalism. And it's a journal that really does welcome people who are having some kind of – well, he describes it as an academic journal with political intent, and that, you know, people who are engaging in not just a, you know, objective, quote unquote, review of a topic, but really getting into it and trying to say something.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were doing a special issue on health, food, sports. And he said that, you know, your paper would fit perfectly. And so I rewrote it a bunch, added some sections based upon the freedom I was just given to actually explore and try to say something, and got it done and sent it to him, and he really liked it, and you've read it. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully, I don't want to jinx it. I'm a very, very negative person. I don't want to jinx it, but yeah, it should be coming out sometime. I don't know, soon. I don't know when the issue is going to be published, but it should be coming out. And the great thing about this outlet is that it's open to anybody. Anybody can go and download it once it's published.
Yeah.
There's no copyright issues. There's no subscription issues. There's no library issues. It's as soon as it's up, anybody can go get it. And yeah. That's going to be awesome. And that's the way I always wanted it.
And we'll be sure to have a link to that so people can download it. I know a lot of people have been asking because we've referenced it so many times. They're like, why can't we read it? And it's, you know, that's why. Until it's published, it's kind of has to remain behind the curtain, so to speak. So as soon as that's published, we'll be able to share it with everybody.
Yeah, I'm fired up. I'm really fired up. And Ben is a really interesting guy. And, you know, we send emails back and forth a bit about running and running issues and ultra running. And, you know, he's a runner. He still, you know, he still trains. Mm. So he, you know, was coming at the reading of it from a very particular, you know, point of view, which was fantastic. And just to give Ben some props real quick, I just want to give his book a plug because I read his book on running and it's pretty interesting. And you can get it from a lot of different places. I just want to get the title right. Yep. It's Body Problems, Running and Living Long in a Fast Food Society. So Body Problems by Ben Agger. Check it out. It's an interesting read.
I just wrote it down. Yep. All right. So cool. Yeah. So we're excited to get that out. And what it did do is it rekindled a little bit of the fire that, we originally had with it, because obviously we spoke about it so much that it kind of fell to the, you know, by the wayside a little bit when we covered other topics, but rereading it, especially with your, you know, revised conclusion and introductions and some of the insight you give along with the data, you know, kind of started me thinking more about it again. And one of the things, you know, that I think that we touch on quite a bit is ultra running is like a lifestyle right. instead of a sport. And that right. seems to be a lot of the, you know, a lot of the responses or the respondents feel that way. I think it was one of the more agreeable answers, wasn't it? When you ask them, is ultra running more of a lifestyle than a sport? And I think most people agreed with that statement.
Yeah, and in one of the useful things of getting, you know, going through this review process, beyond the unuseful suggestions, there was some useful recommendations for literature. There was like one reviewer who actually gave me decent feedback to actually improve the paper. So, reviewer number two, thank you, because we don't know who reviews the things. Yeah. You know, there was a Polish study of ultra running, right? That's not a joke. How many, you know, Polish people does it take to run an ultra marathon? It was really a guy named Paweł Nowak who did a study at the Polish Super Marathon Championships in, what year was it? I don't even know. This thing was published in 2010, so it's relatively recent.
Yeah.
And one of the things that he saw, or one of the things that he said was that it's not clear whether an ultra marathon can be explicitly classified as a competitive sport event or extreme recreation. And I thought, yeah, that's pretty cool, right? I mean, is it competitive sport? Is it extreme recreation? Does it have to be one or the other, right? Why do we have to bifurcate or create these discrete categories? Can it be both things at the same time? Can you cater to both audiences at the same time, right? Which is a question that is explored in the redo of the paper where I had a section on elite runners, the question of elitism or elite runners in ultra. So that's, you know, yeah, it was a cool, kind of an interesting study on from the Polish Super Marathon Championships in Kalisz, Poland,
mm-hmm.
where he did, you know, he did a survey of 54 runners who participated in that race.
Cool.
Yeah, who knew, right? In the 2001 Polish Super Marathon Championships.
Super Marathon Championships.
Yes, held over the distance of 100 kilometers.
And it was 100 people or 54 people in it?
Responded. Okay. I don't know how many people actually were in the race. It's in here somewhere. But yeah, only had 54 respondents. Cool. Good for you. Thank you, Paweł.
But it was the Super World Championships after all.
So. No, it was the Super Marathon Championships of Poland.
Oh, just of Poland. Okay.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
I thought it was another the World Polish. Championship.
It was the Polish Super Marathon Championships.
Oh, man.
Not to be confused with the Super Marathon Championships in Poland. It was the Polish Marathon Championships in Poland. So,
okay.
There you go. And I'm not going to do how many Polish people does it take to run a... I had a joke book when I was growing up, a Polish joke book. We had two of them, actually.
That's good.
Shows you how highbrow my upbringing was. Growing up in Warren, Michigan, baby.
Yeah, I know.
We're the best.
I was in the same boat, basically.
So we got the new paper, new improved paper, and it's cool.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to seeing the responses we get from folks once they're able to actually read through it and digest a lot of the stuff that comes out of it. So that brought up, like I said, some of the things that we've discussed in the past: the lifestyle versus sport, competition versus cooperation, just competing or completing a race. And the notion of identity, and what does it take to consider yourself an ultra runner? Do you just have to complete a certain distance and then all of a sudden you're in the group, or is there some other criteria that has to be met to be accepted into the culture, I guess?
Yep.
So a lot of interesting things. I know one of the things you wanted to discuss about, our sport and what came out of some of our conversations this week was elites in our sport and prize money and making a living at this thing and all that stuff. So I guess we can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, there was a section I added to the paper, which, again, came out of the outgrowth of having two just brutal rejections. So welcome to the life of academia and trying to get stuff published. Given the opportunity that Ben gave me in his journal, I knew I could take, I don't say risks, but I could actually get in some more critical analysis and engage in a discussion that was kind of percolating around the old paper and we've talked about, but is the role of money in elites and ultra marathon events. Mm-hmm. And there was a one of the papers that actually reviewer number two, again, I believe it was, thank you, reviewer number two, clued me in on, was a paper called The Visible Hand, not The Invisible Hand, but The Visible Hand on the Foot Race, Fred LeBeau and the Marketing of the Marathon. And it was in a journal of sports history from 1992, written by Pamela Cooper. And it got into how Fred LeBeau took the New York Marathon and made it into a major marketing event, right? The commodification, to use that word again, mm-hmm. of the New York Marathon, to take it from a very selective, a very elite, quote-unquote, event into making it a people's kind of marathon. And how that was kind of the first major marathon that, quote, used capital and technology to meet a demand that was as much created by road racing administrators and sponsors as determined by the market. So they created this demand. They created a buzz around the marathon. And using technology and money, constructed this major event, right? Again, how dissimilar is it compared to Leadville? Again, I don't want to get into ranking on Leadville again, but the point being that Lifetime doing the same thing, right? It's trying to put money behind the race and make it a bigger event and have it grow. Fred LeBeau did the same thing, and so got into this discussion of how do elites factor in, how does prize money factor into ultramarathon? And that was the section that I wrote for this new version of the paper.
Mm-hmm. So speak on it. I mean, what were your findings or what are your thoughts on it? I mean, did you end up having to define elite?
Well, this is one of the things that, when Ben and I were – I call him Ben because we've known each other now for about 2 weeks.
And you guys roll together all the time.
Well, we're sociologists and we're running sociologists, and how many of us are there, so really? And so he asked the – he actually said in an email, I don't like the term elites. He doesn't like the term elites. And I said I understand why, right? Because raises the question, what is an elite? And I did a little research today on the definition of elite, or what is an elite, or where this term comes from. And for athletics, elite was a term – I didn't do extensive research, so if it's off a little bit, write a letter. And we'll file it or bring a comment to the webpage. Elite was reserved when there was not the category of professional. So if you think back to the Olympics, when the Olympics first started, and not too long ago – Professional athleticism was separated from amateur athleticism. So if you got paid to do any kind of sporting event, you could not be considered an amateur, and therefore you could not compete in the Olympics, or you were excluded from certain kinds of events. And so you had elite as a category. So you were amateur, but you were an elite amateur. Now, of course, we have professionals. And so that raises the question of what is an elite? And I think an elite really then does become applicable to ultras, because how many professional ultra marathoners are there? By professional, I mean that's their profession. They make their living by running. Mm-hmm. How many would you say?
Geez, off the top of my head, I could say maybe 5 or 6.
I mean, quite literally.
Yeah.
I mean, 5 or 6. You mean, could there possibly be 20?
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot more. I don't profess to know everybody in ultra
I don't
running.
Know that there is.
Well, you just look at the Solomon team alone. I know that, you know, a lot of those runners make a decent living being on that team. A decent living being my standard, you know, you
right.
pay the rent and pay your phone bill, and eat frugally. I think they love that lifestyle. And, you know, so I think making a living, quote unquote, at the sport requires a certain smaller lifestyle and, you know, a tighter budget, obviously.
So do you think people are making over $50,000 a year?
No. I mean, I'm sure there is, you know, there are maybe 2 or 3 people that earn that much.
Right.
But yeah, I would say, I wouldn't want to put a price on it, but I would say it's probably far less than that.
So you have people who can make a living, quote unquote, but their living needs are very small. And so they might be their living in a van by the river, or maybe they're living in, you know, I mean, quite literally, right? Yeah. Professional climbers, rock climbers do this. They make a living as a professional rock climber by being sponsored, and they literally live in a pickup truck, and they drive around to, you know, climbing areas. So, okay, that's cool. But in terms of actually being able to – I don't want to get into how does one define a living, you know, $40,000 a year, yeah. $30,000 a year. I mean, you know, so the number of people who are able to live as a professional ultra runner are pretty small, which makes the category of elite really relevant here, because they are – I mean, if you had to define an elite, it's probably defined by results or performance that puts one in a very select company when compared to the population of people who are engaged in that activity. I mean, you could define it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go on to – I mean, I don't know if it's ultra sign-up score. But that's not probably a very good indicator. I was looking at my ultra sign-up ranking for this 40-miler coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hilarious because in terms of its prediction of finish, I'm predicted to finish ahead of Ryan Welts.
And explain who he is.
And Ryan Welts is married to Christina Fulchik Welts. Ryan Welts is a sponsored runner. Ryan Welts has run a lot this year of ultra marathon races. He's a very fast runner. He ran – this is how weird the ultra sign-up thing is. He ran the same race that I'm entered in last year. And finished like in 17 hours and 17 minutes, which is faster than my predicted time through ultra sign up. However the hell they come up with this predicted time, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But his finish time is faster than my predicted time, and I'm still slotted in ahead of him,
What's your perfected or your predicted finish time?
Like 7:38 or something.
Man,
like that.
I think you're going to crush that.
Well, the course is, again, really rocky, really rooty. I mean, like, you know, the top times are like 6 hours.
Yeah.
You know, so who knows? But the point being that he's an actual sponsored athlete who probably would be classified as elite in a lot of races because he finishes towards the front. And rightly so. He should be classified that way if you use that definition. And I'm on the page of Ultra Sign Up. Projected to be more elite than he is. I mean, just it's kind of ludicrous. And so, you know, I mean, this category of what an elite is, what a local elite is, you know, you might not be a national elite, but maybe you're a local elite or an age group elite, right?
Well, you know, that's the interesting thing, I think, when I started thinking about it as we were talking about it this week, is the term elite is a much more subjective term than professional. Professional,
right.
You can define it. It's somebody who makes money, not even earns a living, but just makes, you know, if you give somebody $100 for winning a race, all of a sudden they may be considered professional.
Right.
It's a much more objective term, whereas elite is it varies from race to race. The same person may be elite in one event and be a middle of the packer in another event, you know?
Right.
Whereas a pro, you're a pro across the board, no matter which race you show up for or where you finish, if you're getting paid to do it.
Yeah. And there was an article that I pulled up this morning from Running Times in April 2013 called "The Running Elite: What Does It Mean to be a Professional?" It was written by Parker Morse, and he goes into this, right? What does it mean? And for instance, when I ran the times that I've run the Falmouth Road Race, okay, it's a iconic race here in New England. It draws in a big international contingent to compete. It draws in quote unquote elites and professionals to compete in this race. And you are seeded in the race by your qualifying time. So if you have a qualifying time that's high enough, you get to be put in the first corral. And everyone else is, lined up behind you. Mm. And so I got to be in the first corral. And so I don't know. Does that mean I'm an elite? I sure as heck wouldn't consider myself one. And I don't think anybody else would either. But I got that privilege based on a qualifying time that put me into that category of first corral. And so you're right. Very subjective. And I think because it's so subjective in ultra running, and this is where the paper kind of got into some of the cultural analysis a little bit, and I don't profess to have an answer, but I think people bristle at the term elite in ultra running. And in fact, Jeff Rose in I Run Far in December 12, 2012 wrote a post that was titled "Elite: An Uncomfortable Term." So he's talking about the fact that he thinks elite is an uncomfortable term in ultra running, which I just find fascinating. Why would elite be an uncomfortable term for people to use?
Yeah. It is. I mean, it's anytime anyone has ever laughingly used that term in my name in the same sentence, I cringe. And or other people that are of similar ability that I am, like an AJW. When people call Andy an elite, it's like, ugh, it's so skewed that it's difficult to understand how someone could consider, either him or I an elite, he or I an elite. It's just not, it doesn't fit, basically.
So what would be your definition?
Elite? Someone who consistently across the board finishes in the top 1%.
Ah.
And that I'm talking about everything from North Face Challenge 50 miler, which is hugely. I mean, did you see the quote unquote elite list that came out?
No.
Yeah, I'll send that to you. It's a PDF, I think. It's amazing how stacked that race is with runners. I think the entire Solomon team, including their international team captain, is going to be running in it. That means finishing top 1% in that race and, your local Crowder's Mountain 50K.
Who would be left out of that then? I'm just kind of curious. Because right now, for instance, I'm looking up – it's an interesting case here, Yassine Daboon.
I would consider him, in our sport, an elite.
Okay.
In ultra running. Because it's, the big fish, small pond dilemma. As our sport grows, he's going to fall more by the wayside,
And so who are the bubble elites, would you think? Now, I ask you because you have a far more encyclopedic knowledge of ultra runners and performance and who's who than I do. Who are the bubble elites? Those who are kind of on the fringe of being elite in your opinion, but not quite. Or maybe they are just barely, but at risk of as more people come in, they're going to get bounced.
Yeah, it's easy to do, and it's not calling out people's names and saying they're not they're not elites. But yeah, it's just looking at it pragmatically. Someone like a very nice guy, Gary Robbins from Canada. I would say he's on that bubble, and in a lot of races, he's gonna crush the field, like at the Hurt 100. That's a race that he does very well at. But you put him into a North Face 50 miler and, if he finishes top 20, that's pretty awesome, for
right.
him. And that's in my mind, finishing top 20 at a major race is not elite.
Right.
So I would say he's kind of on the bubble. Someone else from San Francisco Running Company and Marin, the owner, Brett Rivers, is another one. You know, I've watched him come up through the rankings for the last 5 years, and now he's on that bubble, you know, of being elite. He's very fast, runs some races extremely well, but yet I wouldn't consider him an elite in several other races.
Right. Yeah, it's an interesting question, you know. And again, as you said, it's not calling anybody out. And in fact, I mean, when we had the time to, you know, some time to spend with, you know, guys like Nick Clark, or even, again, taking like Nick Pedatella, right? I mean, was Nick Pedatella an elite?
No.
Right? I mean, and Nick would be considered an elite by many, but would he bristle at the notion of being called that?
Yeah, knowing Nick Pedatella for a few years now, I've known him since 2008 when I met him, and, you know, I would definitely say that he would never consider himself an elite. He's a very consistent runner and very strong, and he's one of those people that if someone else who is elite has a bad day, he's going to capitalize on it. You know, that's the type of person he is. Someone else named Nick Clark that you mentioned, yeah, I would consider him an elite. You know, he's one of the people
clearly.
He puts in the work and he shows up at races, and if he's not, you know, top three, I'm surprised usually. And we're talking everything from Western States down to, you know, some small little schmuck race in Southern Colorado.
And is there a hesitancy, you think, for ultra runners who are of this top level in terms of performance? Is there a hesitancy on their part to accept this label?
I would, yeah, definitely. Anyone who has a conscience. Yeah, or some, unless their ego is just like so big that they, you know, can accept that term. It's just when you look at our sport, how ridiculously small and shallow it is,
right?
To call yourself an elite, you know, it would be embarrassing, I think, if someone, you know, if I were to have that title, or, you know, whatever.
And Jeff Rose in his article says, it's just the term elite that so many of us are using that I have a problem with. I think it can and often does come across as arrogant, condescending, and most importantly, inaccurate. And one of the things that he raises is when Run Rabbit Run had two separate fields called the hares, or the faster runners, and the tortoises, and the slower runners. It wasn't separated into elites and amateurs, or, you know, top and bottom.
Yeah. And you could choose what you wanted to be in, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it just, you know, as I went through this part of the paper, and the paper was also not just talking about what is an elite. Actually, the paper really didn't go into that. There was only a footnote on it. It talked more about prize money, but it does raise this larger, interesting question of how this is socially constructed. And also that it does seem to me increasingly, and we had this conversation about Dean Karnazes a little bit, and we, you know, to talk about in terms of even Mike Wardian, with his most recent exploits, that are people looking to construct challenges that automatically make them elites by virtue of the fact that no one else has done those challenges?
Mm-hmm.
And I bring up Mike Wardian, and I don't mean he's doing this just to be called elite, but I make Mike Wardian this past weekend on Sunday ran two marathons in one day. He ran, because of the way the scheduling is, he ran the Phoenix Rock and Roll Marathon, I believe it was, in 2:31, won it, right, in 2:31, which is kind of surprising. You can win a marathon in 2:31, but that's another story.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, he went and did the Las Vegas Rock and Roll Marathon and ran that. I think he finished, and this shocked me even more, I think he finished 10th in 2:57. And the fact that you can finish 10th in 2:57 really is shocking, because that's, you know, not very fast at all, really.
I finished 5th overall in 3:05.
And that's even more shocking.
So I'm elite, actually.
I finished 44th in my 3:05.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. There we go.
But again, if we recall, I was 4th in my age group of those who were USATF members. So I am the 4th fastest marathoner in New England in my age group. So yeah. I guess I am an elite.
Well, I won my age group solely because Marty Wacker, yeah, that's his name. He's a super fast dude and is a very strong ultra runner himself. And he's kind of an elite around this region. He took 2nd overall, and he's, I think, 42 years old, and he ran like a 2:52, I believe, on that course. It's pretty sick. But the only reason I won my age group is because he won Masters, and you can't.
They don't have double dipping.
Nope. Yeah, no double dipping. So yeah.
Bless their souls. I hate double dipping.
I have my first place little trophy up proudly in the kitchen.
Right. Next to your hard rock stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and all my other things that I've won over the years, which is just, it's so many I had to add onto the house. But yeah, I'm going through this quote unquote elite list for the North Face challenge, which I guess now is called the Gore-Tex 50 mile. And it is, yeah, it's interesting to say the least. Some of the names, and like I said, I don't want to call out people's names and question whether or not they should be on this elite list, because I doubt that they had interest in being on it, you know, or had any say in it. I think it was just something the organizers put together to create excitement in the race. But some of the names, yeah, I would, I'd have trouble putting them as an elite status.
And to be honest, you thought you, when you were on the UROC list of elites, right?
Yeah.
You went, what the hell am I doing on this list?
Several people wrote me and said, hey, did you know you're on that list? And I was like, yeah, that's stupid.
That's a typo.
Yeah.
That's clearly a typo.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, it's the way in which I was looking at it for the paper was I was looking at prize money. And I did some quick math, and my quick math might be off, but I was looking at how much you get for winning the Boston Marathon, for instance.
I love that part of
compared to winning some ultra races. And of course, okay, for the Boston Marathon, it's equal prize money for men and women. First place in the Boston Marathon gets you $150,000.
And that doesn't even include, you know, all the other stuff you get. I'm sure your sponsor gives you $100,000, and yeah, you know, there's other bonuses. So that's
just
strictly
pure
prize money.
This is not course record. You cannot set a world record on the Boston Marathon course, because it is a net elevation loss course, which, according to those governing bodies, makes it ineligible. Because I guess then it is supposed to be an easier course, even though it destroys your body when you run it. So $150,000, which is of course $150,000 more than you get for winning the Grand Slam of ultra marathoning,
which actually you have to pay $80 to get in.
Copyright.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I looked at races where you actually could win prize money, and so I looked at, for instance, UROC. Ultra Race of Champions, and for UROC, 100K race has $5,000 for first place.
Wow.
So, yeah. And what my student, Nick LaHecca, who I worked with, he said, oh, you should have compared it to the New York Marathon, which is, by the way, $130,000. Mm-hmm. The London Marathon is cheap, $55,000, and the Chicago Marathon, $100,000. New York Marathon was the final race in like the World Marathon Cup, whatever it was called. So UROC, $5,000 for first place. And so what I did was, okay, let's do some quick math. And I looked at Rob Krar, who won UROC this year. And he won in a time of 9 hours and 29 minutes. He earned about $80.65 per mile. This was compared to Lalisa DeCisa, who ran a time of 2 hours, 10 minutes, and 22 seconds.
At Boston.
Mm-hmm. And he made $5,725.19 per mile.
Wow.
In terms of finishing time, Rob Krar made $527.24 per hour. And Lalisa DeCisa $69,036.05 per hour.
Wow. That's,
or $1,150.60 per minute.
That's pretty good.
Jason Schlarb, do you know him?
Not personally. I know who he is.
Okay. Won the Run Rabbit Run. Say that fast. He won the Run Rabbit Run. 17 hours, 15 minutes, and 20 seconds, he made $579.60 per hour, or $9.66 per minute. And the Run Rabbit Run had a first place of $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go, ka-ching.
And that's considered, you know, one of the biggest paydays in ultra running.
That cash money.
North Face Challenge is the same thing. It's 10 grand for first.
Yeah, and so, you know, it was interesting to see the difference between how professionals are treated in road marathoning and how they're treated in ultra running. And I really got to say, you know, I mean, you talk about sponsorship and value. John Hancock is the sponsor of the Boston Marathon, along with Adidas, right, and the Boston Athletic Association. ING is a former sponsor of the New York Marathon. They recently stopped sponsoring the New York Marathon, the Hartford Marathon, and the Miami Marathon. I just wonder, what do they get for this money? I mean, I don't know that I've ever been more likely to, you know, contact John Hancock for financial services because I ran the Boston Marathon. I mean, it's interesting. I don't know. See, you could make the same argument with NASCAR, right? I mean, do I watch NASCAR and go, wow, I want, you know, I really, really like Kurt Busch, or I really, really like Kyle Busch, I should say, so I'm going to eat M&Ms.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in marketing, I don't think that they think that you're going to see the marathon as sponsored by ING and you're immediately going to use their services. I think it's more of, you know, in marketing, it's more of a subconscious, like if your friend asks you, where do I go for financial, you know, advice or, you know, for investment, that's like, John Hancock? I don't know. You know, it's only one I know of, you know, so it's just more recognition, obviously. But, yeah, it's surprising that ING pulled out of those. You know, I wonder what they were paying for that. I mean,
I don't know. And the article I read in the Hartford Courant, which is the local paper in Hartford, Connecticut, it talked about that they were – it wasn't just the race. It didn't just write a check. They were tied in through wellness programs and community fund runs and all kinds of things and volunteers from ING who would help at the races. And so you know, I'm sure the New York Marathon will not have a problem finding another sponsor.
Right.
Hartford probably will be able to find one too. But you know, it's a tough environment to get sponsorships for different things. And speaking of which, one of the points I make in my paper, was talking about Mike Morton, right?
Yeah.
Mike Morton, who is an elite, would be considered elite by your definition.
Yeah.
World champion, set the 24-hour record, for Americans with 172.45 miles. The dude is in the army, okay? He served his country in war. Given the intersection of militarism, nationalism, and sports that goes on in American culture, and if you don't believe me, just watch a football game, okay? Again, this is not a judgment. This is just an observation. If you want a judgment, you can go, you know, go to Dave Zirin of The Nation magazine, who does a whole thing on sports and militarism and nationalism. This is an observation that a lot is made of intersecting the military and sports and nationalism. Okay? Mike Morton embodies all of that in one package. The guy's in the Army. He was before that in the Navy. Went and stopped being an athlete to go serve his country after September 11th, is at the top of his sport. And there was a local community paper where he lives in Florida, published a story, ultra marathon runner ready to defend world championship title, seeks community support. Looking for sponsorships to help him get to races.
Yeah.
It's just mind blowing because he is the complete intersection of everything that's attractive around athletics.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
It's mind-blowing to me.
That's the dichotomy in our sport and ultra running is you look at the elites and the lifestyles they lead. And, you know, for instance, like Matt Carpenter driving him and his family all the way from Colorado and Colorado Springs or Manitou to the North Face Challenge in whatever 2008 and 2009 when he raced it for a chance to win $10,000.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's crazy. It's like a 2-day drive one way, and you know, I'm sure he didn't live, you know, in a huge you know, Hilton hotel or whatever. I'm sure he stayed in a nice small cheap place and, you know, lived on the fringe basically just to for the chance to win 10 grand. And yet you look at your survey results based on those, the majority of the respondents are, I mean, the makeup is middle 40s, white guy with, you know, 5.5 years of education beyond high school, makes a little more money than the national average or whatever. And it's like, it's just weird that the makeup of our sport, the middle of the pack schmuck, earns more money and lives a better lifestyle in most people's minds than our quote unquote elite runners in our sport. It's just, it's craziness.
Yeah.
compared to even, I know that, you know, like marathoning is still, in my mind, it's still kind of a fringe sport because you, you know, compare it to the rest of the population and, you know, there's not a lot of runners when you, you know, take into account everybody. But even in that sport, you know, you look at the, like you pointed out, the winner of the Boston Marathon is making a pretty good living.
And I would dare say, I don't know, this is my hypothesis, okay? I would dare say that if you went up to the average ultra marathoner, they could rattle off the top runners in ultra marathon, and they could give you their names. Okay, they could say Tim Olson, or they could say, you know, Killian Jornet, or the, you know, whoever, even Anton Kropitschka. They could give you names of people who are finishing at the front. Rob Kraut. If you went up to the average marathoner and said, who are the top marathoners in marathoning today, I will bet money they couldn't give you three of the top 10 of the 2011 world rankings.
I couldn't.
I couldn't either.
Yeah, I probably couldn't pronounce them.
Well, there's that.
and it's, they would say, it's difficult, yeah, to – I mean, it's on – obviously, it's, for me, it's not that interesting basically to follow, you know, marathoning other than if someone sets a record. You know, then
do you – cool. Can you name like the best American marathoners?
No. No.
I mean – I mean, this is the thing, right?
Mike Wardian? I mean, that's the only guy, right, I think I know.
231 is going to put him right there. Yeah. You know, I mean, maybe they can name Meb Keflezighi. Maybe. Maybe they can say Dathan Ritzenhine.
Yeah, Ryan.
Ryan. Yeah. You know, God, now I'm blanking on Ryan's last name.
Hall.
Ryan Hall, who is like, you know, rivaling is marathoning's version of Anton Kropitschka.
No.
Always injured. Please.
Oh, okay. And in that regard.
It's always, he had to pull out of another marathon. He's always, you know, because of being injured. So, I mean, the point being that they get all of this money, which I'm not saying they shouldn't, the Kenyan ones. I mean, this is a major quality of life issue for them and their villages, quite literally, right?
Yeah.
But we know more about our elite athletes in ultra running, but they get compensated less than a marathoner knows about their elite athletes in marathoning, and they get compensated more. It's just an interesting thing, right? It's an interesting thing that, you know, damned if I know why. But I do think part of it is, as we looked at in the survey results, ultra runners really don't give a rip if there's elites in their race.
No.
And if we had, you know, talked to Andrea about this, and she's mentioned about Hard Rock, there's no preferential treatment given to elites to enter Hard Rock. For a long time, there was no preferential treatment given to elites in Leadville, and I don't know if it's changed at all. And even if there is preferential treatment given to elites in some races, you know, let's say in one of your races, Tim, one of the races you're putting on, we're going to reserve, you know, we have 100 or 200 or 300 runner limit. We're going to reserve 5% of those slots for elite runners. What do you think the response would be?
Big deal.
Would people get upset about it?
No, I don't think so. You know, honestly, if it was, you know, I think it comes down to setting the expectations and promoting things and being transparent, as we discussed before. I think if you immediately, you know, put that out there that, you know, we're reserving 10 slots, just like Western States, you know, it's like no one has a problem with them reserving slots for, you know, elite runners to make it competitive at the front.
It's interesting because when the Cayuga Trails 50 had their thing and there was some commentary, and again, some commentary doesn't mean it's a groundswell of negativity, but there was some commentary about that the prize money in the race was, you know, too much. Mm-hmm. And by too much, there was like a $25,000 prize purse, I think. I think it was. I have the actual number here. I know first place got $2,500.
Yeah.
Well, for a 50 miler.
Yeah. Coincidentally, as we're discussing this, while we're on the show.
No, sorry. $10,000 prize purse. First place got $2,500. There were people got upset about that.
Yeah, because it's so much money.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So anyway, what I was pointing out is coincidentally, while we're recording the show this morning, Carl Meltzer signed up for my Zion 100 miler.
Oh, screw it. I'm not doing it then. You're big time in it.
So speaking of elites, actually, he wrote me yesterday and asked what the cap was on the race. So here's a guy who holds the record for most 100-mile wins, which now I don't think as the sport grows, I don't think that could ever be broken. You know, I know a lot of people say, oh, that record is unbreakable. This is one that he has that I think is probably not going to be broken just by the sheer fact that the sport is growing, hopefully. And getting more competitive. But anyway, he wrote me yesterday asking, you know, hey, what's the cap on your race? Not, hey, can I have a free entry or can you comp my entry? Can you, you know, anything like that. It was just asking about the cap so he could sign up in time.
That crazy?
It is.
That's amazing.
I wrote him back. And I mean, I've been friends with Carl for, you know, a few years now. And I just wrote him back. And I'm like, I think you can get my race anytime you want. Don't worry about it. Not only is the cap huge, and I doubt we're going to sell out of the race, but sign up soon if you're thinking about it. But, you know, I mean, here's a guy that I would kill to have in our race. And when I wrote, you know, my business partner with Ultra Adventures, I wrote Matt Gunn and said, hey, Carl just wrote me and wants to be in our race. He was like, his only response was awesome.
Right.
You know, it's not, you know, not should we comp him or anything like that. It's just like, yeah, we'd love to have him in our race. And, you know, it's something I think, you know, it's important to me. And I think it does add some excitement to it. You look at, you know, a lot of like the Facebook chatter and other stuff going on around the North Face Challenge Championships coming up in December next month. And, you know, I think that does create a lot of excitement. I see a lot of comments from people middle of the pack, back of the pack, saying, I can't even believe, you know, how awesome it's going to be to line up with Emily Forsberg or, you know, Anna Frost or, you know, someone like that. And I think it does create a lot of excitement.
I think you're right. And I think, I mean, number one, I think I would love to have a quote-unquote elite on the show to talk with them about these concepts and these things. You know, I think it'd be interesting to get some of their perspective about the trials and tribulations of being an elite. Because, again, one of the things you mentioned, and I wrote down in my show notes because I do show notes, being elite is about – you caught that, huh?
Yeah.
Being elite is about maximizing your performance and abilities through discipline, training, and dedication, right? I mean, so – and, of course, that could apply to anybody. But then when you combine it with high results, it separates them out. But the point that it's not just the cost of traveling to races and doing these races. It's also the cost of time in training for them, right? And – even though I am sure that people who are elites, quote unquote, have some kind of biological advantage, and there's a book I want to check out called The Sports Gene. There was a really interesting podcast on Radiolab about Kenyan runners, especially, you know, more particularly the Kalenjin tribe, where most of the elite marathoners in Kenya come from and why they're elite. And it was a very interesting conversation. It's only 20 minutes long, 20, you know, 30 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things they looked at was, you know, genetics. Oddly enough, one of the things that they highlighted as one of the advantages that the Kalenjin have is they have very skinny ankles and calves.
Mm.
Because, and the reason being that if you tied weights around your waist, let's say you put like 5 pounds around your waist, it would have an impact on your ability to run.
Mm-hmm.
If you put 2.5 pound weights on each of your ankles.
Oh yeah.
Right. And so the more muscular and the more developed your calves and ankles are, the more weight that is and the more that can slow you down. So it was interesting, but I know that the elite athlete in ultra probably has some genetic advantage, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, they also do a hell of a lot of training.
Yeah. Yeah, that's my excuse, by the way, because my calves are the size of a small animal.
Well, I'm Quadzilla, so your calves are the size of a small animal. And, you know, and so, you know, you have the situation where they devote a lot of time to training, too. And, you know, for what reward, you know, it's and then the fact that he's like, I can hear, you know, I've listened to Carl Meltzer on Ultra Talk Ultra podcast. And I can almost hear his voice like, yeah, hey, was wondering how, you know, about what the field size is so you can register for the race. Not asking for any special treatment. And I think that is asking for special treatment, so antithetical to ultra culture. And then the rewarding of special, of being a special snowflake or a special elite, do people see that as being antithetical? And I should remind that from the survey, when people were asked, should ultra runners be given preferential treatment to get into a race, right? 69% of respondents said no. They should not be given – no, I'm sorry. Should the presence of an ultra runner or elite runner in the field make you more likely to want to participate in the event? 69% no. They don't care if they're in there or not. And when they were looking at let me see here. Elite runners deserve preferential treatment for entering marquee events. There was more that disagreed with that. There was slightly disagree, 3.24 out of a scale of six, six being, you know, strongly agree. So more disagreed that they should be given preferential treatment than agreed. So the whole concept of ultra, of elite and ultra, kind of going against the grain there. It's kind of an interesting element that I kind of tried to explore in the, in that paper.
Yeah, it is interesting, that perspective. I mean, I read a lot of people saying they're excited to line up with elites, and yet the findings in your survey, you know, argue that the majority say they don't really care. I don't know. Personally, I enjoy it. I mean, you know, all the races I show up for that actually have – it makes me run better. I know that. You know, like San Diego when I ran last year's San Diego 100, knowing that some solid runners were in the field like Luke Nelson and Jeff Browning and, you know, guys like that, I was pumped up to race against those guys, you know, and it brought my level up. Whereas when you show up at a tiny little neighborhood race, it's like – I think, you know, in my mind anyway, I run a little bit more average, I guess.
Right.
So, yeah, it's exciting for me to have him in there, and I'm stoked to have Carl at the Zion 100. I'm hoping he's thinking about doing the Bryce 100 too, but he's tied up with another race of a shorter distance near that time frame. So he's on the fence whether or not he can make it to the Bryce 100, but I'd love to have him at that as well.
Yeah, I like it when like, you know, I had Helen Wyman at my cross race, right?
Yeah.
Who, you know, and it's, you know, it's cool, and it does nothing in terms of probably adding more people to my race. People who are going to come are going to come. But as a, I don't know, as an ego boost, as a race director, to know that people of that level who have discerning tastes and have raced enough to have a sense of quality, to have them give a kind of stamp of approval that your race is worth doing, no matter how big or how small, as a race promoter, for me, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of neat to say, wow, they want to come out and hang out and do my thing, and then to see them do it is kind of fun.
Well, the exciting thing for me anyway is seeing the Zion 100 course record get broken now. I mean, it's almost a foregone conclusion with Carl showing up. You know,
what's the bonus for breaking the course record?
Oh, lots. I think. I mean, an extra race shirt, I think.
It's not as cool as the prize package that's been put together for a new race that's happening in Vermont. The new 50-miler that I talked about. It's the race, I want to get this right, it's a new fat-ass race that's called the Twin States 50, and it's going to take place in April. The fee to register is nothing. So it's free. There are no aid stations, but it's weird though. And the where it breaks from a traditional fat ass is that there are prizes. A prize is given for the top male finisher and female finisher. And taken from the race site, I put this in the paper. That quote: top overall male and female will win one item from my pantry. This is a race director from my pantry or some other random object. Things in my pantry include canned rabbit, mushrooms, tomato sauce, cream corn, or any variety of things.
Remind me not to go to the guy's house for dinner.
So that is the prize package that's been put together for the Twin States 50 miler, which is going to happen, I believe it's either April 6th or April 7th, just across the New Hampshire Vermont border. So the race is going to run into the 50 miler is going to run into Vermont. I'm sorry, start in Vermont, run into New Hampshire, and then finish back in Vermont.
That's cool. I would do that race in a heartbeat if I lived there.
Why do you think? I knew you would say that. I wanted to ask you, why do you think it's cool?
Well, it's because it's the diversity of it. You know, I've done the big races that cost a lot of money to get into and have, you know, they try to promote it as this, you know, huge thing. And I love those low-key events, you know. And that's – I think you're going to start seeing a lot more of those come out of, you know, of our sport now that all these other racers are trying to grow. And that's kind of what Matt and I are doing with Ultra Adventures, is trying to straddle that line of keeping these races sort of a grassroots, low-key, you know, family picnic type affair with a competitive edge, and also providing, you know, special, like, handmade awards and, you know, great clothes and other swag, you know, to keep it on the upscale. But it's a tough line to hover over. You know, you don't want to turn into a Leadville 2013, and yet you don't want to have it people walk away and say, God, those people were cheap as hell, man. I didn't get anything. You know, so it's tough. But I think you're going to see a lot more of those fat ass type events.
And one of the things I would like to do actually, is do a show on, you know, the fat ass as salvation. And the idea that, I mean, to me, the fat ass is that person who knew you or knew a famous person before that person became famous and successful. And that it's that person who knew you before you became famous and successful, who reminds you where you came from and who you originally were. Mm. And that's the role of the fat ass in ultramarathoning to me. And that's why I kind of think a show on the fat ass, because it does have this potential to say, yeah, you're all that, but you're not all that. And I think that Ultra is uniquely situated to have an event like this. I mean, you know, you could put on a fat ass marathon on the road someplace, but it wouldn't quite work the same way as a trail fat ass. Because this is how it began. I mean, the marathon as an event started as an event, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is how it began. And trail running began kind of like a fat ass, right?
Yeah.
And so it has that. And I want to try something here. I want to read a quote that I have in the paper from Anton Kropitschka. Let's see if I can get this to work. Let me see here. I'm trying to do something new.
Oh, boy.
I know. One second.
It's all right. I can edit this out of the show.
No. This is going to be cool. This is going to be good. Just give me 2 seconds. Give me 2 seconds. So we have, you know, Anton Kropitschka getting red. I'm trying to do sound effects. It's not working on my phone. Oh, hell, later we have to add sound effects. But he says, because when we say Anton Kropitschka, you have to drink. I think the sport is big enough to accommodate both kinds of races, those with large fields, and media, prize money, and a focus in the sharp end, and those that are more low-key grassroots with no fanfare. And so I think that there is something to that, right? That there's probably enough room in Ultra for both, and I think Ultra is unique in that it can do both. And I think a lot of other things like triathlon or marathon can't quite do the same thing in the same kind of way.
Mm. Yeah.
What do you think?
No, I totally agree. And I mean, it's appropriate to have that quote from Anton because he was, you know, part of I think he helped out with some of the organization of the little race series that they do on the Front Range in Colorado. Your hero Nick Clark puts on one of them called the Chubby Cheeks.
Right.
And then down in Colorado Springs, I think Anton was involved with the Ponderous Posterior.
Posterior.
Yeah, that was like another 50K marathon, half marathon. Just a fun event that took place at JT Brownie, John Teicher's house. Is the start-finish. You know, and those actually they're coming up soon here. It's towards the end of the year and the beginning, you know, which traditionally the Fat Ass is around January 1st. You know, and that little race series is going to happen this year, and they're a lot of fun. So, I mean, yeah, it's appropriate to have Anton's quote in there because, you know, he was involved in that, and yet, you know, he's obviously not afraid to race against the best competition in the world at the huge races, and yet still enjoys showing up for these, you know, smaller Fat Ass events.
Right.
Yeah, so I think there obviously there's room for both. It's ridiculous to even – that's not even an argument, I don't think.
Right.
You know, the interesting thing is going to see what the makeup is of the two and the proportion of Fat Asses compared to giant, you know, fanfare events.
Right.
So it'll be interesting to see where it goes. But, yeah, I think that's a good wrap-up for the show.
Yeah. Interesting stuff, and a lot of stuff there for people to chew on, right?
Yeah.
And here we go. I got my sound effects now. So if you say Anton Karpichka, there you go.
Oh boy.
Hey, this is the production value you get on the salary I receive.
Yeah, I know. We'll leave the sound effects and editing up to me. I use a little more than my phone, I think, but. Anyway, yeah, I think it turned out to be a pretty fun show and a lot of stuff to think about. As we mentioned before, your paper will be published soon in your findings with a survey. And once the second that hits the press, so to speak, we will be releasing that link so people can download it and read the full thing. And, you know, we'll look forward to talking more about that. And obviously we want to have Tony Reed on from the National Black Marathoners Association. Hopefully we'll get him on next week, maybe.
And I would like to get him to lead on to talk about some of these things, you know, get to the lead perspective on what's what. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to get, you know, one of them.
You mean, you know, aside from us, right?
From you. You're the sponsored athlete.
Yeah. Well, it is the end of the year, and I've already lost one sponsor.
Ooh!
Yeah. So hopefully I'll be able to retain one of them next year. Otherwise, I'll have to do like Mike Morton and write a little news article and beg for sponsorships and end up with some. Didn't he end up with like Allied Van Lines or something?
Yeah, Allied Trucking was one.
Which makes sense. Going long, you know? I like it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think I just it's just to me mind-boggling that here's a guy that's, you know, is so accomplished.
Yeah, served his country for all these years, and I know a guy who served with him, and you know, I can't because my other friend who worked with him in the army, I can't talk about what they did exactly, but we're not talking about like, you know, the regular army job.
No.
This is elite forces. And they were instrumental in, you know, the fight with the Taliban and stuff like that. And, you know, they were at the cutting edge of that that fight over there. And, you know, so, I mean, this guy served his country for all these years. And like you said, he's like the national champion at 24 hours, you know. And it's like, how aren't people beating his door down? It's the same conversation
right.
I had with Rob Krar, you know, when he was on. It's like, has anyone contacted you? No. I was like, you're kidding. You just crushed the record at, you know, the FKT for the, you know, Grand Canyon, and, you know, you've won all this other stuff, and I can't believe these people aren't beating your door down. But, you know, now he is sponsored by North Face, I think. But anyway, yeah, so it's an interesting conversation we had today, and definitely we'll hook it up. We'll get an elite on here. Maybe I'll chat with Carl and see if he wants to come on and
Yeah, that would rock.
Yeah, he's a fun guy to talk to, and I always love his perspective. He's down to earth and puts everything in perspective for people who start to get big heads in this sport. It's like, yeah, sit down, little boy. I know you've won 100, but you know we're talking, and you know I think he's won like 3,500s now. So yeah, we'll see if we can get him on the show or some other elite and discuss some of the stuff we covered today.
Right on.
So yeah, thanks for being on the show today, Gary, as always. Really interesting stuff, and looking forward to your paper getting published.
Me too, trust me.
Yeah, and you listeners, please, you know, feel free to leave a comment, and you know, we've appreciated some of the emails coming in. We got a couple emails from Israel, so, you know.
Yeah, international listeners.
We are international, big time.
Whoa.
Yeah, and in that regard, if you want to leave a donation, feel free to do so. You can find the button over on the left-hand side of the website. Well, we'll see if you guys can leave some interesting comments that we can, you know, make some new shows up so Gary doesn't have to do all the research all the time to find interesting topics for us.
Yeah, give me more paper topics.
Yeah.
I've got to write more papers.
Did you get that check in the mail yet from me?
Yeah, no. As soon as I get home, I'm going to see if it got there.
Just sit out by the mailbox with your Christmas lights.
Well, actually, yeah, I'll do that. I'll admire my work and my festive home.
Yeah. Good. Well, and with that, I think we've got a wrap. But anyway, I appreciate you listeners once again. And as always, have fun out there on the trail. All right. Good job.
Thank you.
Let me find the button here. I am lost.